Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week is our year-end wrap-up show. We're going to be talking about some things we want to see in 2019 and one or two things that popped up just recently. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news. All right, welcome back. With me this week is Monica.
Hey, John.
And Steve.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you. All right, let's jump into it.
So we're going to start off this week with the latest faceplant in the fintech world, and that comes to us courtesy of Robinhood.
You have a lot of choices.
Oh, well, you know, at the end of the year, you always have a lot of choices to pull from when you're talking about bad decisions, including some of my own, which I just won't detail on the podcast. But some of you may have seen that Robinhood, to great fanfare, announced that it was going to be offering checking and savings accounts with a really nice interest rate, 3%. So I'm sure that was designed to get lots of people to immediately transfer their funds over.
Which I did, by the way.
Which you did.
Did you?
And
just recently?
When I got the email, I signed up, and I was number 333,000.
Whoa, you're
on
quick.
The waiting list.
So
yeah.
Slow.
So slow, yeah.
Well, anyway, your dreams of 3% are going to have to wait until the Fed raises interest rates, because then the SEC came knocking on Robinhood's door and said, hey, did you involve any of your legal or compliance team in here? Because if you're going to call it a checking or a savings account, it needs to be issued by a bank. Robinhood, FYI, is not a bank. And while broker-dealers can and do use a kind of federally run insurance program for deposits in brokerage accounts, Robinhood didn't do any of that prep work either.
What? I thought they just maybe didn't dot an I or cross a T or something minor, but
they didn't
not
do
at
anything.
All?
It does not appear that they did anything.
It was probably a very crowded door when the SEC was trying to get through it.
Well, the SEC put a quick stop to it. And the thing is, like, I don't begrudge Robinhood for wanting to do this.
They moved fast and broke things. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
But what are they getting by moving this fast?
I just think this is a failure of compliance. I think, and we were discussing this before recording, but I think that either their compliance people are incompetent, or their leadership is not listening, or this could have been driven by their marketing team.
Maybe they need to listen to the FinTech Newscast, and they'll hear about all the face plants that happen all the time. But yeah, if you're the compliance officer for Robinhood, then please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com, first of all. But yeah, I hope they're running this by you guys first.
To me, I just, like, when even before it got shut down, I saw the news and I was like, oh, 3%. Like, well, I wouldn't mind putting something in there and getting 3%. And then I thought, gosh, you know, it's not going to be FDIC insured, so I guess it will be coming under the SIPC. And, you know, oh, do I really want to go to that trouble? And then the next thing I knew, the whole thing had fallen apart. But it does make me wonder, and maybe lots of consumers just either don't care that much or aren't paying attention. But I have to say, a company that's gone this sloppy with this part of the rollout, I am not dying to give you my money. I'm not dying to see what you do with it.
Yeah, big red flag, sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where are they based out of, by the way?
I think they're in New York.
New York.
I think they're in New York, yeah.
Well, there's no financial professionals there, so, you can't blame them for not finding a compliance team.
You know, they don't even have an SEC office in New York, I'm sure.
Do they? I don't know.
Yeah.
They're awfully busy, though.
They may be in New York or here in SF, but either way, there's a lot of people with a compliance background who can help you figure their stuff out.
Yeah, wherever you're located, that's not your excuse.
Yeah.
In case that's what you were planning on, head of compliance at Robinhood.
Right.
Maybe this is, a promotional scheme the whole time.
I think it's a marketing play. It's also interesting that
Robinhood, you know, thief.
He's a thief.
He's not like a rule-abiding kind of guy.
He's taking from the rich and giving to the poor, so I guess you better feel confident about your financial status to open that account.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
here comes the sheriff.
Sheriff of Nottingham?
Commission.
No? Are they?
Sheriff of Nottingham.
The Sheriff of Nottingham.
Robin Hood, Little John, Maid Marian, that's all I know.
There you go. that'll make sense, yeah. So, I think this is all based, I think it was all a marketing play, because they offer an interest rate that's almost a full basis point, mm-hmm.
A percentage point
higher than anyone else. So Marcus offers, I think, 2.05%. Mm-hmm. That's the Goldman Sachs.
Yeah,
rate.
I saw that.
And was Amex also has a similar thing at around 2.something%, but this is a full point above.
Right, right. So I was really impressed. It was so much higher.
Yeah, absolutely.
And aren't you, if it's Robinhood, they're probably not making money. Is it that you're being subsidized by rich venture capital investors?
So I looked into this.
They might be making money.
I don't know if they're profitable,
but they do take in revenue.
They do make money, but they make money from high frequency traders, which is a little known fact. So they were founded by two people who came from the high frequency trading world, the quants, if you will. So a lot of what they do on the side is that they have a consumer finance side, but they also facilitate high frequency trades with your money.
Really? I didn't
firms.
Know that.
Yeah, more than half the revenue comes from high frequency traders.
Oh, from high frequency traders.
And I thought, isn't there something around like they make margin investments off the stock that you own in your accounts?
Right. That's also, I think that's a smaller percentage, but it's still, yeah, I think the
that's a normal brokerage business.
So it totally makes sense why Robinhood is doing this. They need more money coming in because the use of that money is what drives their revenue production.
Exactly.
But, you know, God, guys,
that's why they didn't know.
Just check.
This is just a sideline for them.
Boxes. This is not 1929. Yeah.
It was just funny that, you know, when the announcement came out and I saw this, it was like, we're SIPC or CIVIC insured. And then the head of SIPC was like, no, I haven't heard of these guys. Not so much. Who? Robin who? That's what they asked.
No, is this serious enough to bring them down? This sounds like pretty serious stuff.
I think it's just a marketing screw up, really. It's not, I don't think it'll become, they've changed the branding now to make it a cash and invest.
Sheriffofnottingham.com.
Yeah.
Cash management.
Yeah. So it's no longer called a CIPIC insured check and savings account. It'll be like a cash management thing. So they're going to change their branding around it.
And their compliance officer probably.
I would hope.
I am not prepared to only blame the compliance officer here, and I am also not prepared to only blame the marketing people here.
I'll blame everyone.
Hello, the head of the company. Come on.
Yeah. Right. They should have. Well, apparently he's a software. Maybe a software genius that's not...
Not a management genius.
Or a compliance dummy, maybe. That's how these things work.
Ah, huh. Yeah, there's not a lot of regulation around HFT besides the brokerage, the rules around that exchange. So mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think all that I know about the HFT world comes from that Michael Lewis book a couple
Flash
of years
Boys?
Ago. Flash Boys, yeah. That's all I know about it. But it's still... kind of interesting. So we will make sure to link to the article in Bloomberg that details how Robinhood has a history and comes from that world of high frequency trading, which I think is little known by most people.
Huh? Yeah. Well, really interesting. Surprising that this happened, but
guess we'll have to get our 3% from a CD.
Yeah. Good luck with that. Yeah. Maybe in Argentina, you can do very well. I hear. All right. Our next topic is investing in fintech. So we talk just about fintech on this podcast, and I thought maybe people would wonder how you even get into it, how you get some exposure. Now, of course, this should be just one part of your portfolio. You should always diversify, and if it's an alternative investment, like a private equity investment that's not very liquid, and which is the only choice for most of the companies I think we talk about mm-hmm. are private, mm-hmm. then yeah, you should definitely be an accredited investor, and this is a small potatoes thing for you.
And not even should be. You are required to be an accredited investor.
Correct.
Right. But limiting your exposure to the riskiest parts of the market shouldn't be your only, the main part of your investment. Yeah, so it should be, when it's something this risky, just a small part of your portfolio. But for the rest of us who don't have VCs knocking on our door trying to get our money, you know, how do we get in? Now, you can get in through, especially if you're in Silicon Valley, you can't probably throw a stick at a Starbucks without finding someone on a laptop working on their business plan and becoming a seed investor.
Phil's, not Starbucks.
Oh, fails. What about Blue Bottle?
or Blue Bottle, yes.
Yeah.
Definitely Blue Bottle.
Yes. Come on.
or Workshop, but not Starbucks.
Workshop, yeah. There's only two of those, though.
There's like three now.
Oh, there's three, yeah. No, I like those. I actually study there, yeah. So in any case, do you have to be an accredited investor to be a seed investor? Like your cousin is having a company? You give them money, and that's it, right?
You can just be an angel investor with some spare cash, and that's all the requirements, yeah.
Okay, it's only when does the line cross to where it's required that you be an accredited investor?
I think if you offer official securities and it's an SEC regulated thing, then you have to be an investor. But otherwise, it's just angel investing.
Yeah, and I think also it probably has something to do with whether or not there is a fund acting as an intermediary, right?
Right.
So if my cousin is starting a company and I give him 10 grand, that's not the same thing as my going to Sequoia and giving them 10 grand.
Right.
Not that Sequoia wants anybody's 10 grand.
Right.
They're like, yeah. Give me your 10 million.
Yeah, and it's definitely offering to the public. I remember that there's some rules and there's a limit, like up to 25. Credit investors, I always lose track of where that line is exactly.
And I do think it got a little more complicated after, what was it, the Jobs Act?
Oh,
after
right.
The,
right, they changed
after
some
the
of the
financial
rules.
Crisis, so they
right.
did loosen some of the requirements around accredited investing, but it's, you know, do your own research.
Yeah, so that's one way to get in. Help your cousin Guido get started.
So I have a question for this. How does this differ from, say, my investing in one of those fintech ETFs that I see in the elevator?
Hey, you're jumping in my ahead of my topics.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Save your question.
All right.
Thank you for that question. Yeah, so that's one way. But, you know, of course, we don't all have access to that kind of thing. If you are an accredited investor, you go to a venture fund or a hedge fund that focuses on fintech, or at least they probably have one area. A lot of them don't have dedicated fintech funds set up for that, but do have exposure to technology and or finance or small cap, that type of thing.
I think you can also go to a secondary marketplace and buy shares in a specific company. So that if you want to buy shares in, say, Robinhood, you can do that through a secondary marketplace. And I believe that NASDAQ has one as well. So you can actually buy into like Robinhood through NASDAQ and buy shares from an employee.
Oh, is that a formal thing? I always thought they just opened that up at some points. But NASDAQ actually sponsors it.
NASDAQ has a thing called, I think it's called Secondary Markets or Second Market or something. But it's their platform through which you can invest in startups that are public. But I think the startups, they are not public. That's right. Private startups. Although I think the startups have to sign off on their shares being in the NASDAQ marketplace.
Yeah, that's one way to go if you're an accredited investor as well. So there's a couple options if you're already rich.
And for specific companies that you know you want to invest in.
Yeah, that's right. They have to sign up. You have to be interested in that. So there's a few stars that have to align there. On the ETF side, there's only a few funds. I was surprised. I thought I would find more. One of them is, now these are kind of unwieldy names, but the ticker is FTEK, and it's the Invesco KBW NASDAQ FinTech UCITS ETF.
My God.
Let's call it FTEC.
FTEC. Yeah, for so many reasons.
FTEC works.
That's right.
Yeah. FTEC.
How many times have I said that? FTEC.
FTEC.
Oh, are you an investor too?
Yeah.
All right. Well, they're focused just on fee-based companies. So I think they're looking at something to control risk a little bit. That is actually something that's a steady income-generating type of business. And they say specifically, no bricks and mortar.
Mm-hmm.
So these aren't regular banks. These are people that are technology-focused, which as they should be. And this ETF was started in 2016, so not that old. This seems to coincide with the Bitcoin kind of rise. So I'm not surprised to see that time frame. So you can go in and invest in that pretty openly. And they have holdings in smaller, well, compared to the technology giants, smaller companies like, but that are, I think, well known for fintech companies, and some that seem to provide the tools for them to use, like Virtu Financial. They include the CBOE Global Markets and CME Group as well, and data providers like Thomson Reuters. So not strictly
why they're there. Price and Reuters.
Yeah, yeah. So they're a data provider and more like a trading back end kind of thing, like HFT kind of pipes, nanosecond type of trading execution. So so that's one option. Another one is Finex, F-I-N-X. That's the GlobalX FinTech ETF.
That's the one I've seen in the other.
Yeah, right. They spend a lot of money on advertising. You know, I saw this.
You know where your fees go.
Well, I was about to get to that. Look at the administrative fee percent because they're spending a lot on promotions. I saw them actually on CNBC during their trading day kind of thing, actually all the time. So they're spending a lot of money on these nationally advertised venues.
And all the elevators.
And the elevator, too.
The
oh, maybe too. That's CNBC is the back end of that.
I think it's Capture or Captive, that company that handles
The elevator they probably bring it together.
Captive is right.
Captive,
yeah. Right. So, yeah, a very heavily promoted fintech ETF. And they mentioned that they're focused on the leading edge of the emerging financial technology sector.
So how does this work? So they create together a basket of private fintech companies and then sort of
not private.
Them.
These are public.
So these are public.
Public. So what's a public fintech company? Like Square?
Square.
Sure. PayPal?
Yep.
So that's actually two of their top listings.
Oh, there you go.
Also Intuit, SS&C Technologies Holding, which I'm not exactly sure what they do, but
so they are they're a back-end financial technology provider to a lot of different kinds of financial firms. They also own Advent Software.
Oh, yeah, that I've heard of.
Which is a local company that SS&C acquired a while back.
Oh, okay. And we've mentioned Guidewire Software before.
They do insurance, so they're making a play for efficiencies for insurance companies.
Okay, so it looks like Finex wouldn't be a bad play if you want exposure to fintech, some of the names we've mentioned before. And some bigger names like Fiserv and PayPal, as we mentioned. So I think that's the most flexible way to get exposure, but you can't really control the profile of that ETF, of course. And then there's the old standby mutual funds. So again, pay attention to the fees, how much they're charging in there, especially with something that's more volatile and you know maybe has a lot of demand for it. Like some technology mutual funds, they might have higher fees than some other more stable, long-term type of mutual funds. But it's kind of hard to find a fintech-focused mutual fund. I was looking for a while, and so Fidelity has one, but it looks very low-volume traded. Mm-hmm. The performance is terrible, and not just recently, which, I mean, you would expect in the past few months, But since the inception of this thing, so you know, none of this is investment advice. We're just making you aware that these things exist. So I would probably go with maybe small cap, big tech finance companies for mutual funds.
Yeah.
And those are few and far between as well.
Well, and you know, there are certainly people whose school of thought in investing is that you don't want to be sector focused. You want to be kind of growth or value or mature or less mature companies. And, you know, all of these publicly traded companies appear in other kinds of ETFs and mutual funds based on kind of growth, value, large cap, mid cap, small cap.
Right.
And that's a way to kind of not necessarily be quite as exposed to the vicissitudes of an industry.
We only use big words here.
That's right.
Take
that's
the right. Word. I took the GRE.
The V word.
Don't
word.
Make me spell it.
GMAT.
No, GRE. No, not GMAT. No. I didn't go to business school.
All right. And, you know, there's always the reliable standbys for any boom, which technology is always related to. And we've definitely seen with the blockchain boom and continuing bust. Let's see what 2019 brings for us. But there's, you know, the tools these companies use. So things like Amazon Web Services is like the standby. They have so many tools, and Amazon until just recently was doing very well on the back of those profits. Cybersecurity is a big issue, and that these companies, except for Robinhood, have to comply with certain cybersecurity rules.
Right, you should.
And so there's some IT indexes. giving you exposure to, in some cases, you can look for companies that provide fintech and banking backend services. Cloud computing is definitely an area that's driven by fintech and drove the acquisition, as we said before, of Red Hat Software. Also, there's companies that are in finance that are investing large amounts into the fintech world. We mentioned before how JP Morgan was putting 1,000 people into an innovation lab in Silicon Valley. MasterCard has its own labs where they're testing different payments, international and also consumer-facing type of payments, new ways that they can do that. So that's another way to get exposure. And in those two cases, having the stability, some stability of already a large profitable company attached to it as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of ways. Hopefully that's giving you some ideas to start your own research on what fits for you. And what do you think you would invest in?
Picks and shovels all the way.
Absolutely. Brex. Brex.
Oh, Brex. That's not a pick and shovel. That's
It's a credit card for startups. I think that's not fintech specific, but it could be used for startups to like do their expenses.
Oh, my God. You're paying too much attention to bus stop signage.
Yeah.
First of all, again
with the fintech.
Brex lost me with the name, and then they lost me with the credit card for startups.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. What's different about
it? It's just a corporate credit card, and it's all it has a cool mobile app.
Yeah,
and the card is heavy.
But it does have
cool.
a $1 billion
the
valuation
point,
too.
The point
it's crazy.
Of the card is to not need the app.
I know. Yeah. But it looks so cool, and you can do expenses.
The
from
more
there.
Money they're putting in that app, the less I want them.
Yeah.
John, what about you? He's Brex. I'm picks and shovels.
Yeah, you know, you can't tell the future. You can only bet on the technology. So maybe just some pool of an area. You know, my dream would be to customize one of these ETFs or mutual funds. Because I just don't know which one is going to be the big winner.
I actually think that even in light of the recent bear market, there's a lot of growth to be had in the asset management space. So a lot of the wealth management stuff as well could be kind of interesting to bet on. Especially if you can pool like Betterment and Wealthfront and personal.
They'll have to buy out each other eventually, huh?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh God, will they?
There's might.
Always
I
consolidation.
Consolidation.
But
absolutely.
Right now we only have two.
No. There's quite a few. There's SoFi, two big ones. Yeah.
Two big ones.
Yeah. There's other like secondary and tertiary players, but I think that my bet would be to invest in sort of some sort of wealth management thing, a pool of wealth management startups.
Well, certainly we are embarking upon the greatest wealth transfer that the world has ever known. And, you know, everything that we know about millennials shows that they do want to manage their money in different ways than their parents and grandparents did.
They want to have a cool app.
But you grandma.
Know, just for the record, Steve's too old to be a millennial.
As we look at his gray hair.
And my turtleneck. Oh,
man.
He's Steve Jobs today.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm in a jazz cafe.
Yeah.
Okay, we have to take all that out. All right. It's too mean. And I'm sorry, I started it.
No.
Well, it is a little almost goatee thing. It's reminding me.
He is the youngest
cool,
of
man.
The three of us.
Oh, yeah.
I'm 40 years old. Like,
oh, yeah. Not a millennial.
I'm not a millennial. Yeah.
But you're on the cusp.
A geriatric millennial.
I'm a very young Gen Xer. Yeah.
That doesn't sound better.
No. A young Gen Xer. Yeah.
This looks like your back hurts.
I'm a very young Gen Xer.
Yeah. I'm a really young. I'm a young baby boomer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh God, I'm dying.
Yeah.
Okay. So, in keeping with the year-end episode, let's go to our holiday wishes in fintech.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have a wish. Do I have a wish? I have a dream. My dream is that when I go to, not Starbucks, when I go to Phil's or Blue Bottle or Workshop and I swipe my card, I want to see real-time settlement in my accounts. I want my app from my bank to reflect my payment or my charge within a couple of hours. I hate to see pending transactions.
Your definition of real time just changed.
I know. Well, yeah.
No, make it instant. It's a dream. It's a dream.
A dream. Sure, a dream. Instantaneous.
Sure.
I go by lunch. I swipe my card or tap it, whatever, and then I open my app and I see my balances change. No pending transactions, and it's all just there. Like the bank knows that it's me for some reason. I don't know whether this is a Fed thing or a bank thing, but I hate that, you know, sometimes payments or charges can take a couple days. I'm glad, though, that they changed the rules on debit so that before they used to stagger them, right, by amount. Remember that? That rule changed like 4 years ago?
Well, so that's to get the more overdraft fees,
right? More fees, yeah, yeah. So a couple of years ago, if you had $100 in your account and you spend 40, 30, and 30, right? Mm-hmm. That's $110. No, that's $100. My math skills suck. Say you do 40, 40, and 30, they would process the $40 first, then the second $40, and then the $30. And that meant that you could easily be over.
Oh, and let's say there was like three $2 charges after
those
that.
Those would go last.
Those tiny $2, $4 ones would go at the end, so you'd get an overdraft fee on each one of those.
On each of those.
Instead of the one $40 one,
right,
which it could have been.
And those could be $35 a pop for like a $1 overdraft.
Did that change during the financial crisis?
It did. So they changed the rule in that to make it so that the banks have to process stuff now in order as the stuff comes in, not by size,
not
by amount.
Minute.
Yeah. So my wish list,
but still overdraft fees are still going up.
It's still going on. Yeah, they're
going up even.
They're going up. Yeah, yeah. They're a big source of revenue for most banks. And yeah, but my wish is that we could have real time settlement for credit card and debit. Just take it out or put it in. Just do it quickly, please. Don't wait 2 days to do it.
So I think the good news there is that
blockchain.
Well, blockchain and also just kind of the pressure that is just coming on the payment space from all of these incumbents duking it out with insurgents. You might get closer to that.
Fingers crossed.
Is it computing power or?
I don't think it's computing power. It's just the way that they do the
ledger. It's a system.
Yeah, I think it's probably a lot of it is just legacy.
It's a legacy system. Yeah.
Systems.
Yeah.
And as we see, I mean, those have to be coming to the end of their useful lives anyway, and we're in this place where technology is so much better. We've got cloud computing, we've got blockchain.
It's
got to
be the
things.
System then, right? Yeah,
I think so.
Process set up.
I think so.
I don't know. I enjoy running to the bank right after I bought a latte to make a deposit, and and so it doesn't go over.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
So what's your year-end wish list?
For my deep holiday wish, I look forward to robust federal privacy legislation.
Ooh. Oh, so you're a communist. You want to be like those Europeans.
Not only am I a communist, I might be delusional.
You want a baguette and a beret to go with that?
And there are certain things around Europe's version of this that I would like to import, but by no means is the European version my end-all be-all. But some of the things...
Oh my God, I hate the, like, you know, the splash thing on a website. We have to click, okay, we take your data. Come on, it's so annoying. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes,
yeah?
I do. And that doesn't really bother me so much. But some of the things that I think it would be really wonderful for all of us to have is for the ability for us to tell an organization that has our financial information that, no, they can't give it away or sell it to someone without our permission.
MasterCard cannot sell your data to Google or Facebook so they can match purchases to their advertising, like that kind of stuff. That shouldn't
exactly.
be taking place.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that shouldn't be happening
so
now.
So the GDPR stopped that specific example?
I'm not sure about that specific, but that's happened. That happened this year with Google and Facebook, where they're buying transaction data from MasterCard and Visa. So don't do that.
No,
don't
that's
do
not
that.
Cool. I would also like for us to have true ownership over the data that we give to these organizations and for us to be able to delete what we don't want them to have if they do not necessarily have a business need to have it.
Yeah.
And...
Sorry, on that note, I saw today that it's been 9 months since Facebook announced they were going to give users the ability to delete their browser history.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I've been enjoying
been
that.
Still hasn't been deployed. 9 months later.
Don't hold your breath.
Move fast and break things indeed.
Yes. Mm.
So I saw some example where they said, oh, in the future, in the year 2020 maybe, that you would be the owner of your digital profile online and you could be the one selling to advertisers or exposure as you decided, so that Facebook and Google wouldn't get all that money. You would control that.
Because advertisers are really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
And then the other important element of this is that I think it should already be illegal for companies who you are not doing business with, who you do not have a relationship with, to track you online and have shadow profiles created
yes.
for you. And right now, we don't know necessarily that financial companies are doing that, but we also don't know that they don't. and we do know that companies like Facebook are doing that. And I find that horrifying, because there is absolutely no way for you to have any control over what they're doing, and you're not even their customer. You've never even opted into their services. So I won't hold my breath on any of these items, because I do think that they are not 2019 gifts coming in our stockings, but I...
Yep, good luck with
dream.
That, Monica.
One can dream.
That's a few hundred billion dollars against you.
Yes.
So I'm gonna bet on...
Very powerful lobbying dollars.
The lobbying. Yeah, that's another part of the system that it's not helpful.
No.
All right, I think my wish list would be... kind of maybe a smart assistant that could help me do research.
A smart assistant.
Yeah. An actual smart, just smart, yeah.
A smart assistant.
You're assuming too much here, huh? So when I do research on an investment or I'm looking at an area that might have exposure, you know, that takes a lot of time. You know, if I allowed it, it could take 100 hours of looking at different areas, different parts of the internet, different companies, different services, to put something together. And we see that a little bit when we even research this podcast. So my dream, if you will, would be like something that could read things and understand them and bring things back to me based on my parameters. And let's narrow it down to, let's say investing parameters. So as to have a certain risk profile, it has to be in a certain sector, or bring me back interesting things, which I might be asking for too much, because the new areas evolve, right? There might be some other thing that might apply that could be high growth. But setting those parameters and having a really smart assistant, kind of like what we see in the movies, right, where they they bring you back that thing. So again, maybe definitely not a 2019 or 2020 thing, but that would be my wish. Saving hundreds of hours would be great.
And he does not want a financial advisor, in case any of you come back with that.
Right. Yes, please email Monica@fintechnewscast.com if you're a financial advisor.
If you're an advisor, yeah.
All right, now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the story behind it.
I'll go first. My number is 170%, which is how much shares of Square were up through the year before the market pullback in September. So Square has been on a tear recently. They've released a couple of really interesting products over the past few months, or years rather, including Register and Terminal. They've kind of polished the reader they have as well now. So that's been reflected in their stock. And if the market hadn't pulled back, their stock price would have been up, I think, something close to 200% on the year, which is incredible. So
Coulda, shoulda, woulda.
Yeah, I think they're up now only 72%, which is pretty good. From, you know, they IPO'd, what, 2 years ago or so?
It's certainly more than the rest of the market.
More than the rest of the market, absolutely, yeah. So, and also this is, by the way, done on under the helm of Jack Dorsey, whatever his issues with going on a meditation retreat in the middle of yeah.
So I've been on a Vipassana meditation retreat, and it kills me that he's giving it such a bad name. Thanks, Jack.
There you go.
Well, why is he giving it?
Because
he's associated
he's
with it?
He's a solipsistic techie. So he goes and spends 10 days in the Burmese countryside, comes back and raves about it. And I understand that, having done two of those, like, you feel amazing when it's done. But he just completely neglects to mention once that thousands, tens of thousands of people are being killed in Myanmar. And most of a good part of how people get the message to go kill their neighbors is through social media.
Yeah. A bit
but
frustrating.
I don't even have the words.
Yeah. So go Square, don't go Jack Dorsey.
Okay. All right.
My final bite, I'll try to be calmer. Because that's what a Vipassana meditation practitioner would be.
Yeah, it was pretty obvious you've been twice, Monica.
U.S. student loan debt, outstanding loan debt, reached a new record this year. It is $1.465
trillion. Billion dollars? No, trillion dollars.
Trillion dollars. So that is just a huge number, and we haven't really lived in a world where young people are carrying that kind of debt. The other thing that's important to note here is that over 90% of student loans are guaranteed by the U.S. Department of Education. So in addition to this being something that really weighs on the debtor, it's something that is probably going to end up on all of our plates eventually.
I think half of that is from Trump University, isn't it?
I think a big chunk of that is.
Oh, God.
My God. If you're listening, do not go to a for-profit college. For God's
sake. Yeah,
yes,
yeah. Anytime I see
half of it probably went to the University of Phoenix.
Private universities are.
Do not do that.
Private for-profit.
Bad news. For-profit. Yeah. Harvard, okay.
Fine.
University of Phoenix, not so much.
Yeah.
But yeah, I am so happy every time I see a for-profit private university go out of business. There was one that went just recently.
There's
really
so many
bad news for the students that are halfway done.
Yes.
And already borrowed. But for the long term, it's better, less of those.
I'm sure Betsy DeVos is all over that. Don't worry, John.
She's trying to fix it.
She's on a hunger strike for them, yeah.
Yeah, this current debt level has more than doubled since mid-2009. So this is a huge run-up in this type of loan debt.
Yeah, it's still less than credit card debt, but it's still a gigantic number.
And credit card debt, you know, if you really get into a bad place, you can discharge through bankruptcy.
You can.
I don't think we've talked about it here, but there are starting to be some loan judges in the wilderness who are actually canceling out discharging bankrupt debtors.
I've read about that. I wonder how often that happens,
though.
It's
very small scale right now.
I thought it wasn't.
It's one-off.
You couldn't do it at all. I thought it was illegal to do so.
No, there have been some judges who have done it, so I think
they interpret the laws.
Yeah. So it's just something that I think is a real drag, and I mean that in the economic sense as well as the mental sense on young people's aspirations and the way they plan their futures, and it makes me very worried. I hope that we can find a way to help them manage this load and realize their dreams.
Totally Monza, dude.
Fintech startup. There you go.
Yeah.
Like the one I'm going to talk about. My number is $4 million, and that's the amount that Be Social has raised in their funding round.
Is that the letter B?
That's the letter B dash social. They're attempting to create a social bank, combining your social media and your groups with your finances.
That sounds delightful. Tell me more.
I feel like I'm in Westworld or something. Welcome to. So they're using this money to get a bank charter. They're not quite at that point yet, but they want to do things like share payments or with like maybe roommates. They can do a bill and they all share information for these financial needs. Through their app. The app is a big part of their product, as you would guess. It's still in a beta with testers and employees, and it's based in London, one of the tech capitals in the world, and a financial capital so far.
So
let's see what happens. Another experiment. I like to see experiments. This one's, I don't know what's going to happen with this one.
It seems like its utility is really only realized if you have some of your own financial network in it.
Yeah, right.
It's no good for me just to join up. I'd have to get my roomies and my landlord.
So what? Yeah,
right. It's that type of thing. So
what's the product?
Well, one example is that if you go on a trip and we go on the FinTech Newscast junket to Burma, and I pay for the three tickets, and then we can exchange funds, paying me back for the flight.
Oh yeah, there's no other way to
supposedly
do that. We really need Be Social for that.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it's maybe building up some social network. They're trying to experiment with combining that.
Actually, you could do some really cool things there. Like, you could get a group of people together who maybe want to save for that trip, right? And this is a way to kind of carve out a particular account, and everyone can kind of contribute.
Oh, yeah.
And you can show and log, hey, you know, Steve's already contributed $300. John's done $5. Where's Monica with her $50? You know?
Kind of like they try to do with exercises. Monica ran 3 miles. I got to run 3.1 today.
Yeah.
So a little bit of that, yeah. Yeah.
We'll see what they do.
Yeah. Be ready for Be Social.
I will be ready for Be Social, absolutely.
Let's see if they make it to a B round. All right. That's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest episodes, and have a great 2019.
Thanks for listening to us this year. We hope to enjoy next year with you as well.
Talk to you in 2019.